This documentary aims to explore the realities faced by Chilean citizens under an oppressive dictatorship. Throughout, you will get to hear the real-life stories of Chileans who were detained, tortured, and exiled to England following their opposition to the new regime. First, let's take a look at the history of Chile to gain an insight into how such terrible events came to pass. For decades, there had been political instability in the country. In 1960, historians Frederick Pike and Donald Bray foresaw the catastrophic future of United States and Chilean relations. They warned of the increasing acceptance by the US of the right wing in Chile, who alleged that claims of need for radical reforms and change were not to be trusted. The United States had, in a sense, colonized Chile, as a large proportion of the Chilean economy was controlled by United States corporations who exploited their natural resources, such as copper. Therefore, there was tension from the working class, as money that could have contributed to the Chilean economy was instead taken out of the country. Throughout Chile's political history, many attacks carried out by the military were against the Chilean population. Even before the dictatorship, they were responsible for the deaths of many. This violent history of the Chilean army against their own people gives us an early warning sign as to what they would become capable of. There was a shift in attitudes in Latin America after the 1959 Cuban Revolution, headed by Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. It gave rise to left-wing, trade union and working-class movements. The people wanted radical reforms to combat the social inequalities being faced by a lot of the population. In 1970, left-wing parties in Chile joined together to form the Popular Unity Party, known as Unidad Popular, led by socialist Salvador Allende. Allende's party won the elections by a landslide, and they quickly began to make reforms to many sectors, including housing, education, welfare, and agriculture. However, the Popular Unity Party faced opposition from the right wing, the rich elites, and the United States. These groups tried to undermine the government with attempts to ruin the economy, and propaganda was created that portrayed Salvador Allende as being in allegiance with the Soviet Union. By 1973, tensions had grown as increased conflict between the right and left affected the economy, leading to high levels of inflation and a food shortage. People began to protest, and the probability of a military coup became more likely every day. With the reality of this coup becoming more apparent, many citizens wanted Allende's government to slow down on their reforms so as not to provoke the right further, whilst other members of the population wanted to resist. On the 29th of June 1973, there was an attempted military coup which failed to succeed. However, this only fueled tensions further, and both sides became increasingly more agitated. On the 11th of September 1973, General Augusto Pinochet led the military coup that would overthrow the democratic government. News of the coup was broadcast on the radio, and the population listened in as the armed forces attacked La Moneda, the palace of the government. Salvador Allende was inside the building and refused the military's initial request for his resignation. He gave a final speech over the radio, knowing that they would be his final words. The palace was bombed, and President Salvador Allende was killed. The following interview extracts come from a group of Chileans that participated in the project We Touch the Sky. One participant, Sergio Requena Rueda, recalls the last words of the former president.
I won't resign. I won't go out of the palace of government. The only way that I will go out will be with my feet in front.
Another Chilean, Apollo Santana, weighs in on his memories of that eventful day.
Basically, you know, they attacked Allende. Allende refused to resign, which showed the quality of Allende. And when I listen to Allende's final speech, I don't think in the history of mankind, and don't believe in the history of mankind of modern time, there have been a more dramatic, better speech, a meaningful speech than made by that man.
The resilience of Salvador Allende in the face of death has placed him at the hearts of many Chileans as one of the greatest leaders in their history. His leadership has been a symbol of hope for many, and he was taken too soon by a barbaric regime. Pedro Fuentes was also living in Chile at the time, and he shares his thoughts on the coup.
I remember the coup. But I personally never thought what's going to be like that, never ever. The President Paz would be bombed, people being actually killed on the street by Chileans, killing Chileans. We never thought that. People being detained, tortured.
For the Chileans, their society had been a democracy for centuries, and the dictatorship that followed was something that they could never have imagined. It quickly became apparent that members of the population who had supported Allende and the Popular Unity Party were now in danger. Curfews were immediately put in place, and calls for the arrests of Allende supporters began. In the days following the coup, violence flooded the nation. Many activists were arrested, tortured, and killed. Law and order no longer existed, and terror spread through the country, as civilians were publicly executed in the streets. It became clear that if you were not on the side of the new regime, you were in danger. Benjamin Vergara Carvalho from Temuco in Santiago was 23 at the time of the coup. He had completed his military training and had been working as part of the team of bodyguards who protected Salvador Allende. He was also a member of the MIR, the Revolutionary Left Movement, and he describes his actions on the day of the coup.
A meeting the same day in the morning as to what we're going to do. And some of them were higher up in the rank, said we're going to go underground until we know what's happened. Mm. And said, well, you do that, but from this moment on, I take charge and I take responsibility of being the chief of the MIR and of the whole two provinces. You are no longer members of the of that section of the political party. So I stayed there in Temuco and tried to reorganize everybody, not just my party, but all the political parties I knew, because the repression began immediately. And that's how my experience to the beginning of the exile started in Chile. Mm. So I finished being a civilian to being a political and an underground, and then a political prisoner, passing for torture and imprisonment and then exile to be here today. Mm. So those are the two big lump of what of my life has been until now. 23 at the time of the coup, 26 when I was expelled from Chile, and now I'm 67.
Sara DeWitt, also from Santiago, was 22 years old when the coup happened. She was a social work student at the University of Santiago. She recalls her experiences from that day.
Well, that day was absolutely horrible because the killing started. That day I had myself a very important test in the university, and having studied until late, leaving the house early, and I noticed that everything was so weird and mad. But anyway, I had to go for my test. I went to the university, and when I arrived there, everybody was running like mad rabbits. And someone told me, look at what is going on. And it happened that airplanes were bombing the House of, what did I say? The House, no, it wasn't the House of Parliament.
The House of the
La Moneda. The presidential palace, yeah, shall we say.
Sara was also a member of the MIR. Her role included selling the newspaper of the organisation to workers. When the coup began, she and some friends went to a shanty town and hid for 3 days during the initial curfew, in the hopes that other members of the organisation would rescue them. They soon realised that this wasn't going to happen, as people politically affiliated with Allende's government were the first to be kidnapped and killed. Sara recalls her experiences of those initial days.
Well, after the third day, people could come out. I came out and I went home. I went home, and when I arrived home, I found that my mom was doing exactly what millions of people were doing. She had taken my books and burned them. They put them in the rubbish. And it was a shock for me. I mean, and it was funny because she took some of my book, academic books, and left the Lenin or Trotsky books, you know, lying around. Now, there was such a panic in the population because in the TV, the army was appearing and making pronouncements, like threatening people, basically, and giving names of people who have to present themselves.
These announcements originally stated that if certain people came forward, they would receive a fair trial. However, it quickly became apparent that this was a lie and a trick to kidnap people who were against Pinochet's regime. It was later discovered that there were no fair trials, and thousands of people disappeared with no explanation. In 1974, Sara returned to the university to continue her studies. However, this was short-lived as the secret police were made aware of her affiliation with the MIR. She describes the moment in which she was taken.
Anyway, I was finishing my training. I had 3 months more to go. And then one day I was walking in the street. I was on my way to hand over some microfilm to someone. Fortunately for me, I couldn't take the microfilm that day, but I went nevertheless. And when I was walking in the street, these people that were coming from behind me, they grabbed me from the back and they put something on my back that my assumption was that it was a gun. I couldn't see what they put. And they said, don't move, freeze. If you shout, if you scream or try to run away, we're going to kill you. And we have got a gun. So I just stood there, and then a car approached, and they say, walk, walk to the car, don't make a noise. Well, I walked to the car, and then in the car, I sat there, and there were probably some, nearly 5 men in the car, and what they started doing was hitting me. Hitting me, oh, we got you. Anyway, apart from hitting me, they took me to somewhere in Santiago. I knew that they were taking me away from the center. Now, the point is that I didn't exactly know where, because what they did, they put sellotape on my eyes. I had to close my eyes, and they put sellotape. And they took me to that place. They were still hitting me. And the other thing that they were doing, they were touching me everywhere, you know, my breasts, down there. And I'm saying that because that is what the secret police do.
It was clear that the rules and regulations of a democratic society had been thrown out the window, and the soldiers of Pinochet's dictatorship were above the law. They were in charge, and they could get away with doing what they wanted, when they wanted. The trauma didn't end there for Sara, and she was taken to a building where she describes one of the atrocities that she witnessed.
But that night, what had happened, that outside the room, I could hear that they took a man. I really don't know why, but they were very vindictive. And what they did, they hung him and they hit him with chains. Now, that is still with me because it's so horrendous when you hear when they are killing someone and the sound of the chain in someone's body and he's screaming. Now, at some point, he stopped screaming. He was just making some noises. And these, there were, I don't know, some 5, 6 men. They were so excited, laughing. They really enjoyed and they would say, go, hit him. It was horrendous.
This traumatic experience has stayed with Zara ever since and raises questions about the people involved. Who were these men? And how did seemingly ordinary men suddenly become capable of such barbarity? To commit such atrocities with no evidence of remorse is an act usually associated with psychopaths. Is it possible that all of these men already possessed psychopathic tendencies? Or has the environment of political oppression developed these characteristics? Christopher Browning, a Holocaust historian who has studied how ordinary people are able to commit such atrocities, says that governments have the power to create these behaviours in people as they prey on their conformity and desire to be held in esteem of their comrades. We see this in the situation faced by Sara, that through the encouragement of the other men in the room, a man was murdered. Being a woman at the hands of this macho environment made Sarah's experiences of torture more sexually focused. She was continually asked why she had gotten herself involved in things that belonged to men, and the attacks against her were much more centered around demeaning and humiliating her, she explains in her own words.
What they did with me, what I'm going to tell you this, it's basically because that is what the army and the secret service do everywhere else in the third world countries. Yeah. And I have no doubt to believe that they have done that to women in Sudan, women in Libya, everywhere, wherever they go and invade. Anyway, what they did, they took me the following morning, yeah, very early, they took me out, and again, you know, hitting you, touching you. They took me to a different place. We arrived to this place and we went to house, yeah, we went with the car inside. Anyway, they took me to the house and basically we went to the first floor of the house and they said there, well, we are asking you to cooperate for your own good and so on, so on, so on. And they said, all right, take off your clothes. And I said, why? Take off your clothes, otherwise we are going to take it. Now, and my guess is that probably there were 15, 20 men. Now, I took off my clothes. I was blindfolded. Yeah, I couldn't see. I took off my clothes. What they did when I finished taking off my clothes, they dragged me and put me in a sort of frame, and they introduced me, I don't know, something inside my vagina, and they start with electric shock. Now, the electric shock is absolutely horrible. It's horrible, horrible. Now, they would stop asking more questions. And the other thing, they touch you everywhere.
Under oppressive regimes, the degradation of women is all too common. However, sexual crimes and abuses often go unreported as they are much more stigmatized than other violent crimes. When the dictatorship ended in 1990, collecting reports of the human rights violations carried out under the regime was important for the nation to get closure and begin to heal. Testimonies from women like Zara enabled perpetrators to be brought to justice. At a similar time to Zara, Benjamin was also captured. He had been working with the MIR and, as a consequence of his association, he was on the run from the authorities as a wanted man. He details his experience.
I went to Valparaiso on the second night, and somebody, a neighbor, yeah, had said in that house there were people that were not known in the house. And the patrol went to that house and took me and the friend that owned the house, and we were taken to an interrogation torture center in the Navy in Valparaiso. We were taken to the Navy Academy in Valparaiso to be interrogated, questioned, and whatever they wanted to do, the intelligence service of the Chilean Navy. And that was my very first experience of torture. And there was a point when the torture got to the Russian roulette, they passed me a revolver and one bullet, and said, put it in the chamber, and then run it, and then a question, squeeze the trigger. Apart from the punches and kicks and the other, that was an electric shock. That was the same for 8-10 days. Not convinced of that thing, so went back incommunicado to the jail. And the following day, it wasn't the army that went to pick me up, it was in the Air Force. And that was a different story. The only thing I can remember is the chief of the intelligence service of the army in Temuco told them, don't mark it, no lo marque. I didn't know what he meant by that. It was later on that it meant nothing to be shown in my face. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Probably because if I was going to be shown to some people, which I was, that they wouldn't see me any bruises on anything in my body. Under my shirt or anything, it's a different thing. So I spent 44 days going from place to place and being electrocuted. Kick, punch. Injected with pentotal. Different kind of drugs. Until, nearly on the 41st, 42nd day, I just said, well, just confirm who I am with my General Arellano. And they stopped everything. They took me back to Temuco.
These forms of torture were commonplace during the dictatorship. And for those who survived, the effects of these violations are still felt today. Benjamin now lives with a permanent disability due to his experiences of torture during this time. It is hard to imagine what it would feel like to be in a similar situation or how you would react if you were. Both Benjamin and Sara expressed their unwillingness to cooperate with their captors, and both withheld information even when they were being physically tortured for it. Benjamin explains his thought process.
If I say yes, they're going to hit me. If I say no, they're going to hit me. It's the same, maybe the same would happen. So if I just say no.
Being in a top position of this revolutionary group, Benjamin held a lot of responsibility on his shoulders. It is a testament to his character that even under extreme torture, he never revealed important information. When he was 16, Benjamin had joined the Young Socialist group, which sparked his interest in politics. He then went on to complete his compulsory military training and found himself as part of the Socialist Party with one of Allende's daughters. During this time, he was trained to use guns, including snipers. He was promoted to second lieutenant in the reserve army. However, he decided that he didn't want to become an officer and instead became a part of the protection group created for Salvador Allende as he was running as a candidate. It was after Allende was elected that Benjamin joined the revolutionary group MIR. During this time of instability and repression, the normal rules of society are thrown out the window, and people must do what they can to survive. During our interview with Benjamin, he confided in one of his most painful memories.
There was another occasion. Is that on the night of the 11th of November, I needed to move a few things from one place in Temuco to another. And because it was a curfew from 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he mentioned that we have to go as in hiding as possible without demolition. So we went through the one of the cerro, a hill in Temuco, where it has a huge, a lot of trees. It's a building and it's a historical place and it's a natural reserve. So there, but one of the people that was going to be in that group was followed by someone. So a military patrol dropped in that area half an hour after we all got together. And it started firing everywhere in that cerro in Temuco, Cerro Nielol. We have a few gunshots, a rifle, .22, I had, and a pistol. With the adrenaline of the moment, we decided to resist. So we used some of these grenades we had in some of the bags that didn't work. We shoot back with the gunshot or the gun and the rifle, that's it, until a moment during that incident, there was a silhouette in the front of my rifle.
Benjamin was relieved to have only injured the man, as he was forced into a situation that we can only pray that we would never find ourselves in. Many Chileans still carry the weight of guilt with them over actions they were forced to commit during the regime. Many political refugees who have fled the country may find safety abroad, but their psychological scars will never be healed. With more awareness and understanding, organizations will be able to provide the best services for refugees who have suffered under political oppression. Sara DeWitt benefited immensely from international organizations, who, along with the help of her family, were able to obtain a visa for her to leave. Sara was eventually freed from jail and exiled to England. The world outside was very different to the one she had been in for 2 years, and she discusses adapting to her newfound freedom.
Now, as I came out, that was a big experience getting, you know, used to be free again, because something that I couldn't do, but I couldn't do, was to look at men in the face. Yeah. To start with, I was for 2 years with only women. And in some occasion, I had, for example, I had to go from inside the detention center from A to B. And as we were walking, for example, and there were some male detainees walking, they would say, look down, you know, by screaming at you. So if I saw a man, you know, I would just look down. And the streets, I saw that the trees were so large. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I was at home. And then I started receiving calls. My mom was picking up the phone. I wasn't allowed to pick up the phone. And the phone were, tell that so-and-so, that was me, that we are going to kill her, blah, blah, blah. Now, I don't know myself whether they were, if it was true what they were saying. Some people who came out free, they were killed. I don't know. I was really scared. By then, thanks to my mom and international support, I had a visa to come to England and I had a place in Bradford University.
We often talk about post-traumatic stress disorder in relation to soldiers who have returned from war, yet civilians who have witnessed similar atrocities are often overlooked, especially when individuals have been exiled to a country that is unfamiliar with the situation that they have come from. Sarah discusses returning to Chile for the first time since exile in the 90s after the dictatorship had ended. She visited her mother during the new elections.
And I arrived one day before the elections, and I went with my mom to vote, to a national stadium that it was a center for detention. We went there, and my mom was queuing, and I was standing with my daughter, and there were a lot of army people patrolling there. And then I see a group of people coming from far away with a candidate, probably an MP candidate, and they were shouting, screaming at him, "You are a thief, assassin, you name it." And they start approaching. And I was so scared that I took my daughter, who was probably 4, I threw her to the floor and I went on top of her. Because what an army person moved a machine gun, he moved it. I didn't know. He moved it from one shoulder to the other. But when he was moving it from one shoulder, I thought that he was going to shoot us. And then, when nothing happened, I lift my head and I see my mom that is the color of a beetroot with the other one, because she didn't know what to say. Oh my God, I said, oh my God, I want, you know, to go into a hole. I was embarrassed. But that is to show you about the reaction. Sometimes they are an irrational reaction and they don't have, they don't keep a distance with reality, yeah? You overdo it because with the fear, yeah? Of course, I wouldn't trust the army, but I think that they want to kill people. That is what I believe.
It is easy to take for granted the sense of security that can be felt in our everyday lives. The behaviour of political refugees may not always seem rational. Therefore, it is important to develop a better understanding of the traumas faced by these people so that we can be more aware of their behaviour and how to help. Sarah quickly transitioned from a prisoner to a refugee. When she arrived in England, she received support from an organisation called Joint Working Group for Latin American Refugees. Volunteers met her to welcome her into her new life and aided her in finding accommodation. She started studying public and social policy at Bradford University and quickly made friends. However, there was still a lack of knowledge by the general public about the situation in Chile, and Sarah found herself wanting to educate people and tell her story.
I always said that I was a political refugee because one is that I don't feel embarrassed, and the other thing is that I got that in my head about if I could to tell what I'm doing now, if I could to tell people, you know, what happened. I mean, why I'm here. I think that, you know, I remember when I was living in university and people wanted to hear me, I would tell them, because many people don't know why you moved. They think that you came here on holiday. No, I came because they bloody destroyed my life over there. Yeah, mainly to pass information to people. Because, you know, sometimes, and I spend sometimes always imagining what my life could have been in Chile, and I would never know.
This is a sentiment shared by thousands of refugees who have had no choice but to flee their own country. The experiences faced by the Chileans are unfortunately not unique, and similar events have happened across the globe throughout history. In order to consider the factors that led to the dictatorship, we must first consider the history of Chile. We already know that there had been political instability for some time, and that the United States had great power economically and over the military. But to what extent did the US contribute to the rise of General Augusto Pinochet? According to renowned philosopher Noam Chomsky, the US has a long record of opposing democracy in Latin America and intervening to prevent it. He also claims that the United States had the power to prevent the dictatorship in 1973. The socialist policies of Salvador Allende were clearly not in the interest of the United States government, and he was seen as a threat. The Nixon administration implemented economic measures on Chile with the intention of weakening Allende's government so that it could be overthrown. Author Christopher Hitchens argues that the involvement in Chile of Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, presents a strong case for him to be tried for kidnap, torture, and murder. At first, President Nixon publicly showed support for General Pinochet and defended his regime. The involvement of the US in the coup became controversial as more and more human rights violations were being reported. When President Carter came to power in 1977, human rights and foreign affairs were at the forefront of his new policies in order to regain some trust in both nations. According to Professor Margaret Power, Chile has become a case study of the damaging effects of US intervention in Latin American countries. And whilst efforts were made by the US government to reverse the damage they had caused, the dictatorship was enabled for 17 years. Pinochet's regime ended in 1990 with the democratic election of President Patricio Aylwin. The new president had the challenge of healing a betrayed nation. He began legal proceedings to acknowledge human rights violations that had taken place during the dictatorship and began to bring the relevant people to justice. In 1991, the government issued the National Commission for Truth and Reconciliation report, which concluded that 1,102 people were officially declared as disappeared and 2,095 people were declared as executed by torture. For those who were disappeared, there was no record of their death and no bodies recovered. Still today, people are trying to find out what happened to their loved ones. The implications of this report meant that members of the military were convicted for their human rights abuses, and the nation could finally begin to mourn and heal. It is important that the victims of this tragedy are never forgotten, and for those that survived, that their stories are told with accuracy and dignity. This leaves us with many unanswered questions. How can a democracy be so easily converted into a dictatorship? What are the early warning signs we can look for? Does this environment enable the development of psychopaths? How can we respect and understand the experiences of political refugees? And what lessons can we learn to ensure that history does not repeat itself?